Anita, how's your mental health?
Questionable at all times, you know this.
Yeah, how's the mental health of your children?
Also a little bit tricky. Can I tell you my experience in trying to find therapists for myself and my kids, Mel?
Yes, please.
Okay, this is how it goes. You ask around your friends and your family for a referral for somebody who's nearby. You finally find somebody who sounds like they might work for your family. You give them a call and you find out that A, they're not accepting new patients, or B, they have a huge wait list. So you start over again and you ask people if they know anybody who would be a good therapist and a good fit. Finally, you find one, you go and you meet with them, and you figure out that you don't actually like them that much. But it's been so much work to find somebody who you can go to in your area that you're kind of stuck with them. Well, do you have any ideas for how to get around this?
I do because guess what? I've actually had some therapists that I have found on my own, which involves what you're saying. Sometimes I remember one time I was like 3 hours in the bathtub on my phone looking through websites. I was such a prune at the end. But I have also had the experience with working with BetterHelp, and it was like I don't want to say too good to be true, but because it is true, but it's like amazing because I was matched with my therapist within 24 hours.
And you didn't have to go through all of that other ridiculous process of trying to find somebody. And here's the cool thing, too, is if that person didn't work out for you, you can just switch and say, and it's not like you're committing to another years long search for somebody who you're going to jive with.
That's true. And I lucked out, or maybe just BetterHelp is really good at matching people together because I never had to change my therapist. I loved her, perfect fit for me. And I know that some of our friends have used BetterHelp and they've had to change therapists, and boom, same day, you can change.
Easy
You can ghost your therapist, get a
peasy.
new one.
I love this idea. BetterHelp is one of our sponsors. If you use our promo code trybetterhelp.com/WWDN, you get 10% off your first month, and we totally recommend it.
Yes, get some therapy. That's
Ha.
trybetterhelp.com/WWDN. Anita, you're so far away.
Greetings from planet Earth.
From planet PNW, Pacific
Yes,
Northwest.
I am in Oregon. I can see the ocean out my window.
Tell me how your trip's going.
It is going well. Better than Arizona. Sorry, Arizona. Oregon is winning.
What's been going on?
So we've just been chilling out. We're going to the beach. We went to Ripley's, believe it or not, today, and it was not that unbelievable, actually. My kids, I paid so much money to go there. I thought my kids were going to love it. And it was like they were in a contest to see who could walk the quickest through
Oh gosh.
the, and I'm like, no, stop. I paid $109 for us to be here. You need to look at the exhibits. That's okay. And then we went and saw the sea lions. And then I spent a bunch of time looking for sea glass, which
Well,
is
that's
super
fun.
exciting. Yeah. And I found a bunch of pieces of it. And I was like, it's the jackpot. And then I got them home and they're so small, they're tiny, but I still am excited about it.
So you've had two trips in less than a month, and one of your goals is to be back to the adventuring family that you used to be. So, what's your assessment
Yes.
so far?
I like it. It is so hard and so much work. But when we were driving here, I was like, I want to spend all my money on this. I don't care about food. I don't care about education. Let's just go places. And it's been really nice just to be us and not to have somebody along to quote unquote help, because then we can just be us and I don't have to be worried about managing my kids for other people. Does that make
Right.
sense?
Yes.
Like, I don't want them to be bothering other people. I don't want their mess to be there for other people. I just don't care when it's just us. So, except for I'm
Good.
pretty sure we're going to get kicked out of this condo because we're so freaking loud. A lady came out as we were walking by and told us we were too loud and needed to move along.
What?
It was like 12, it was like high noon.
Move
I'm like,
along
lady,
way to where?
we were walking from one place to another. We were too loud. And I was like, it's not 6 a.m. I ripped open my shirt and it was like, I'm a widow.
I was gonna ask.
No, I wasn't wearing that shirt. But I wish.
Well,
how are you? What are you doing?
I was a guest on a podcast this last week.
I know. I listened to it. It was really good. I was really impressed with you, Mel.
Oh, thanks.
It was kind of fun because you were talking about things other than the things we normally talk about. So I thought it was fun to listen to you talk about music and stuff that I never talk to you about.
Well, it's called the Happy Musicians Podcast. It's made by this guy, Tanner. He's 23. He's a drummer. He just graduated, I think, with his master's from Indiana. And he's been doing a podcast. And props to him. He's got a good thing going where he's addressing mental health concerns of musicians and kind of just opening up the discussion. So good for him. It was fun to be a guest. There were some things, I mean, of course, I talked about trauma and grief and how to move forward or how to sit with it. And so it kind of tied into widowhood, right?
Yeah, there was definitely some parts that were widow related. So good job.
When you're learning a skill like music, it's a language. And so you're always in this lifelong thing, kind of like grief, like a lifelong journey of it changes over time or different situations present different things. So there are a lot of parallels. So it was fun talking to him and interesting to be a guest and also kind of scary because I didn't have editing power like I do on ours. So I probably sounded stupid sometimes, but it was fun.
I did a guest spot also, Mel, where I was not in charge with the Modern Widows Club.
Yeah. Is it out yet?
It kind of is. It kind of isn't. Yes. It's on YouTube, but they're launching it at the end of this week. So we'll link to it on the 29th is when it's officially coming out. So also you created a new sleep track.
Oh yes.
A fall asleep track for everybody. Cause there was a lot of chatter in the Widow Wives Club about not being able to sleep anymore. And you were like, okay, I will make you some music.
Shout out to our friend Phyllis, who started the conversation in the private Facebook Widow Wives Club. I have a YouTube channel that I started at the beginning of the year for meditation and relaxation music and sleep music, sleep soundscapes, which include ocean waves and falling rain.
Which is where I am right now.
So yeah, I actually have a lot of stuff up there. And I thought, oh, well, I already know how to make these tracks. And I'm seeing that so many people were commenting on her thread. Yes, yes, yes. I cannot sleep. This and that. So I made one.
Way to go.
Do you want to know how I made it?
Yeah.
I mean, of course, I was playing the piano. But when I was playing it, I would try to breathe in and out at a rate that I would if I were sleeping. Don't worry, I didn't fall asleep.
If you were asleep and playing the piano, that would have been rad. You would be like really cool.
Fun fact, I can actually do that. I trained myself to do that where I could be asleepish and playing on a gig. Because we did the same stuff over and over for years. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Okay.
I'll show you sometime. So anyway.
Yeah, I want to see that.
My YouTube music channel is called, and I'm going to actually put an audio clip of our friend Constance, who is Swedish, in there, pronouncing it correctly. But it is called
Drömkatt.
And I will link to it in the show notes. It's always been there, but now maybe more people will need to find more sleep music. I have 8-hour tracks. I have 1-hour tracks. I have 9-hour tracks. Like, there's all sorts of things. And even if you don't use YouTube generally for music, because you're worried about having a timer to shut your phone off, if you have an iPhone, and I'm sure Android does this as well, you can set your phone to stop playing whatever your phone is playing as a timer. So you can turn YouTube on and then like also still go to sleep and not have it going all night unless you want it to. So yeah, check it out. And if you would like me to make a track for a specific issue that you are having, let me know. I like doing it. It's all just to help everybody. And if you are into that kind of thing, please subscribe to my channel. That helps me out because then YouTube recognizes it. But other than that, it's free.
Yeah. I have no skills like that to offer any of the widow wives. Sorry.
I beg to differ. You can wrap wounds pretty darn well.
But I'm pretty sure that none of them need that service or skill.
So one of the colleagues at the church where I play at, her son died from a car accident. And I saw her a few weeks ago for the first time after it happened and give her a hug and, you know, nobody ever knows what to say, but you want them to know that they're loved and that you're thinking about them. And it's that thing that we talk about all the time, Anita, where it's like, it's happened to us and then it happens to others. And we're still like, ah, this just sucks. And I wish that I had the words. So we talked again today and she was talking to me about early grief stuff. Of course, it's almost been a month. And it reminded me that it's important for people that are in fresh grief to know that your memory is going to be wonky, especially if you have a sudden death. And so that was good to talk to her to remind me of our friends that are widows that are dealing with like fresh grief. Your memory is going to be broken. You're not going to have a great concept of time. You might feel like you're trying to do one step forward and you go five steps back. And it's like that for a while. It's hard. So it's a good reminder for me for that. And I also learned something about the brain, Anita, that helped me to be like, yes, this is why. Do you want to know?
Yeah.
This is from The Body Keeps the Score. I'm obsessed with it right now. I'm reading it. We have the brainstem. The brainstem was the first part of the brain that was developed in our bodies, right? So it's basic functioning, like breathing, sleeping, eating. And then everything past that is a little bit of a higher function, right? Until you get to the prefrontal cortex, which is all of the fancy things, like showing empathy and memory and remembering things. When we have a death or trauma or something like that, your brainstem is sometimes the only thing that's functioning at a certain level. So that is scientifically proven that your brain is a little bit broken. So if you're feeling those things and you're in early grief, that's why. Your brainstem, it's doing a good job of helping you to keep breathing. But if you feel frustrated, like, oh, I just can't do what I was doing, or I'm trying to get like one step ahead and it's not happening, it's totally normal. It's scientific facts.
It's science.
Yes.
So funny, not funny, was that this week I had a friend call me, and when she called me, I was like, that's weird, because people don't call anymore. And she was like, Anita, my friend's son just died. I'm on my way to her house. Like, what do I do? And I was like, it's weird to be in a position where people call you as the expert for this type of thing. It happened twice this week. And I was telling her, because this had just barely happened, I was like, you treat her like she's a burn victim. It's like, keep them warm, keep them protected from more trauma, you know, keep them hydrated and just be there for them. And then I was like, and you're going to want to feel like you can fix it, and you can't. It's hard.
It's solid advice. It sucks that you can't fix anything for them.
I know. But we just want to so bad. It's like everybody just wants to swoop in and do something to fix it. And there is no fix for it. There's nothing in the world that can fix it.
Nope.
There's not enough Diet Coke in the world.
Okay. Some people might disagree with that. But... So if you find yourself feeling like you are a sociopath and you don't know where your thoughts are going and why you're thinking different things all the time and it's changing, it's totally normal for what you're going through.
And here's some Diet Coke.
And a donut. Uh-huh. You know what's awesome, though? In the same day, Anita, you and I got emails from two different people.
Yeah, we love these emails, you guys. We had two different people reach out and just talk to us about how the podcast had helped them and how they were able to take some steps forward that were big steps and just feel good about their progress.
Yeah, we love hearing that. And we love hearing what you guys are doing as a result of finding a widow community that gets you. So feel free to drop us a line anytime. We love hearing what you're up to, and we're all here to help each other. So keep it up.
Yeah. And we had a lot of people participate in our Widow Win Wednesday, which is also fun to see what people are able to accomplish and do, whether it be a huge win or a tiny, tiny win. It's all wins. I'm feeling pretty good about getting my family to Oregon. Like, that was a big win for me, even though it's not Wednesday. That's the problem, is never do my wins happen on Wednesday.
You just need to put it in a note in your phone so you can remember. Well, that's one of the reasons why, even though, of course, it starts with a W, that's one of the reasons why we started it to be on Wednesday, because sometimes the first of the week, we're busy if we're working or we have kids that are going to school. And so a lot happens Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday is, of course, kind of the midweek slump.
It's the hump day.
So that's why. Yeah.
Yeah. Speaking of the Widow Wives Club, make sure that you check us out on Facebook. And if you want to join our Widow Wives Club, it's a group for only widows and widowers. Answer all the questions. And we would love to have you join our community. Get a lot of good interaction in there.
And the definition of widow and widower is anybody that has lost their person. If you are not married, you count. Come on in.
Mel.
Yes? Dear?
Yes, dear. Can we shout out our patrons now? We're going to start our shout out with our dead husbands. Thank you so much. To begin with, we're going to shout out our secret husband.
5, 6, 7, 8. Go, widows, go. Disco Inferno! It's just an old classic. We needed to do that again.
Yeah, we did. And then we're going to continue on with classy Constance Dahlbach.
Dashing David.
Dizzying Dawn Satterwhite.
Interesting Ivan Meisner.
Crazy Cat.
In the best way possible. Thanks, Dead Husbands.
We'll continue with our Widow Wives and Widow Besties.
We have amazing Amy Sapp.
Awesome Ashley Han.
Marvelous Mindy Holmgren.
The dashing Danielle Katterberg.
Divine Dennis Brazzo.
Jazzy Jenny Taylor.
Jumpin' Jenny Wang.
Kooky Keto Kirsten Stromberg.
Congrats on your new house. Lovely Laura Bradbury.
Mischievous Missy Schubert.
Rad-tacular Rachel Barbosa.
Stunning Sarah Morris.
Stupendous Sylvia Shore, my mom.
Crafty Karen Cornejo.
What's another word?
All I can think was animatronic.
Animatronic Anna Tracy. Anita made that one up. Please don't blame me if you hated that one.
Doing this on the fly, and it's going interestingly. Charismatic Christina Scambato.
So charming Christine Anderson.
Dramatic Diana Becker.
Excellent Emily Thornton. Excellent.
Ecstatic Emily Toledo.
Embraceable Aaron Posick and Opal.
Glorious Gabe Lozano.
Interesting Ileana Bell. Ruiz.
Jovial Sister. That doesn't make any sense. Jangling.
Jangling? Jingle, yes. Jang? What?
Jingle, jangle, Jamie. Jingle, jangle, Jamie.
Okay, I'm going to make you do all the J's because I can't come up with any more words. My brain's shut off.
Yeah, there's a lot of J's.
Go.
Jingle, jangle, Jamie. Joyous Jenny Barrow.
Wait, also the J could be a yuh sound. Like Jägermeister Jane.
Jarlsberg Jane. Freaking fancy lady. Jubilant Joy. This has gotten out of hand.
Keep going.
Crawdad Katie Rack.
Crawdad! I'm sorry, Katie.
Right. Oh, we've got another K.
Craptacular Kara. She's my best friend. She won't care.
Luscious Lori Farrington.
Oh. Musical Marie Hoffman. Her backyard is looking so good.
Did we do magical already?
No.
Majestic Marjorie Lewis. Magical Mary McGowan.
And Sarah's probably going, shut up.
Sensational Sarah. Sublime Shannon.
Sometimes we assume that unless we had a huge life insurance payout, we don't really need to know anything about investments or even finances. But guess what? A little knowledge of finances is critical for all of us. Maybe your partner was in charge of that stuff, and now you find yourself making all the decisions. Maybe you're mad about that. Maybe I am. Nicole from the He's Gone, But the Money's Not podcast is here to help. She tackles financial literacy by telling the stories of women and widows and finance experts and shares the lessons they've learned as certified financial planners. Whether you know a lot and feel confident in your financial decisions or feel unsure about all of that stuff, there is more to learn. Listen and subscribe to the He's Gone, But the Money's Not podcast on all podcast platforms. This ad was paid for by Rock House Financial, an SEC-registered investment advisor.
Keep going. I can't do it. I can't do it anymore. You go.
Sleepy sunshine.
Just keep going.
Tremendous Tammy. Terrific Tara.
Voluptuous Val. Hey, she will take that as a compliment. Huh, Val?
Okay,
bye-bye. And last, but certainly not least, pretentiously polka-dotted Wendy.
Oh, man, guys. That was harder than we thought.
We're recording this way after when we usually do it in the day, and my brain is fried, so... Thanks for taking over, Anita. Also, good job.
Thank you to all of our patrons. If you want to join our Patreon, go to www.patreon.com/WWDN.
We have 4 tiers. It starts at $5, and that helps us to keep the podcast going.
We can give you a really terrible descriptive adjective before your name.
That only Anita will do, because...
My favorite was Crawdad. Oh, so sorry. If you would like to only buy us a taco, visit buymeacoffee.com/widowwedonow. This episode is brought to you by the Meisner Family Foundation in memory of Elizabeth Meisner.
So this episode was a fun one for us to record. We really had a fun time talking to our next guest. And since our episode has been recorded, he has made the book available that he talks about in the podcast. So please check our show notes for that and check it out for the link.
I'm Anita.
I'm Mel. Sort of.
We're two widows with amazing verbal abilities. And we're trying to figure out widow we do now. Wow.
We're a trio of trouble.
Should we meet who's here to talk with us today, Mel?
Yes. Anita, who do we have with us today?
We have Peter Rukavina. Peter, welcome.
Thank you.
I think you're officially our third widower. Is that right, Mel?
I think so. Yeah.
Yeah. So thank you for being one of the small group of widowers who is willing to be a little vulnerable and talk to us about grief.
Well, I think the thing that brought me here was widower number two. And some of the things you discussed with him about being widower number two made me think there should be a widower number three.
Absolutely. Tell us a little bit about yourself, where you're recording from and what you do and a fun fact, maybe.
I am recording in Prince Edward Island, Canada, which is Canada's smallest province on the far east coast, kind of sandwiched between the mainland and Newfoundland. I was born in New York, grew up in Ontario, and moved here in 1993. So I'm into year 29-30 of being here. I moved here with my late wife, Catherine, I don't know why I said wife, because we were never married, my late partner, Catherine. My day job is making websites. My night job is using a 100-year-old letterpress to make interesting things. And
wait,
this is amazing. Stop.
like one of those old-fashioned presses that you like put things in and then like squish it down,
like newsies,
exactly like newsies. Yes, yes. So
that's cool.
Yeah, it's kind of,
you do that just for fun
primarily? Yeah, I mean occasionally I sell little bits and bobs, but not in a way that sustains me economically at all, but it certainly sustains me spiritually. So
how long does it take to make something? Does it take a really long time? Is it worth the effort?
That's a good question.
I guess it's like everything. Yeah.
Is anything worth the effort, Anita? Let's be honest.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Why would we make music? It's such a hassle to make music. I think for me, it's worth the effort. I mean, it's I have a day job that is infinitely flexible. You know, websites are never done. And, you know, you put ink on the press and you make something and then you clean up the press and it's done. You don't go back and change it. So I like the restrictions that it imposes upon me. It's a good kind of counterpoint to my day job. So.
Yeah, I relate with that. Like, parameters are necessary sometimes when you have other open-ended things.
Yeah, yeah.
That is a fun fact.
I've been to PEI one time because we played a festival there. Can you please tell us about the Anne of Green Gables culture there? Thank you. We cannot let that go unsaid.
I have been asked that question in many places all around the world. Yeah, it's, you know, Prince Edward Island is home of the fictional character Anne of Green Gables, which people often forget, and they go looking for her actual house.
Although, are you serious?
Yeah, there is a physical house that was the house of relatives of hers that, or of hers, of the authors, Ellen Montgomery, that is kind of a tourist mecca here. And then from that, you know, the Anne of Green Gables China doll industry and the Anne of Green Gables musical industry and the Anne of Green Gables tour industry have sprouted. So it's kind of our Laura Ingalls Wilder trail.
That's,
I guess,
what I was going to say, because she was real. So people, like, that was based on a true...
I didn't know she was real. So thank you for telling
me. I think that I'm going to be nervous that I'm getting it wrong, but I'm almost positive that, yeah,
no,
she was
real.
A real person. Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Do you secretly hate Anne of Green Gables?
Yes.
That wasn't even that secret.
I used to have an office that was on the other side of a very thin piece of drywall from one of the two Anne of Green Gables musicals, which I heard probably 1,500 times and could probably be a stand-in in if called upon. So hate
for Anne?
Well, no.
Or Gilbert.
For Gilbert, probably.
Okay.
Although probably I could do Anne's part.
We call that position the swing. The swing can do any track.
He's the pinch hitter. So, Peter, tell us how you met your partner, Catherine.
I had an interesting time in my 20s, kind of wearing all sorts of different hats. I worked in a newspaper for a while. I did graphic design. I worked in a museum. At one point, I kind of found myself between jobs, and I had a friend who was going to El Paso, Texas, to learn to be a midwife, and she had a two-year-old and no one to look after her two-year-old. So she said, why don't you come to Texas and look after my two-year-old? So
you were the Manny.
I was the Manny. So I lived in Texas, in El Paso, from, I think it was August to November of 1991, I think it was. And then her husband was able to come and take my place. And so I was done, and I kind of cast around looking for something else to do next. So I moved to Montreal, kind of on a lark, and spent a very cold, dark, unemployed winter in Montreal. And then the opportunity to take a job at my old college town presented itself. And I just, like, almost instantly ran back to the small town of Peterborough, Ontario. And Catherine was the person who handed me the keys to the house next door that I moved into. So I was her next door neighbor for 3 or 4 months. And we ended up both being single, and kind of, we both had roommates that kind of conspired to get us together. And so then, yeah. And then a year later, we moved in with each other. And a year after that, we were casting about for a new adventure. And I got a job way out here on the East Coast, and she agreed to come with me. And we kind of stayed together.
So how long were you guys partnered?
28 years.
Just a few years then.
Just a few
just
years.
Just a couple.
Yeah.
Oh, man. I think that the that sounds like a Netflix reality terrible show, an unemployed cold winter
in Montreal.
In Montreal. Yeah.
Do you speak French?
One of the things I did in my long, cold, dark Montreal winter is I went to the Catholic school board to take French as a second language, which was interesting. I took French all through school, but I've emerged.
Did you know
able
good?
No, yeah. I can order a coffee, but that's about it. So.
Yeah, that's useful.
The important
too.
Things.
Yeah.
So tell us a little bit about Catherine. From what we understand, she was so amazing.
Yeah, she was It's kind of a miracle in a way that we got together because she was weird. Like my first memories of her in the adjoining house is she used to have like wild bonfires in the backyard with all sorts of bearded men who had kayaks on the roof of their trucks. And she was an artist, and so she was always collecting bits and bobs of metal and wood from the neighborhood and piling them up behind her house. And she was very much a free spirit, and I was very much a square. And but something in the jigsaw puzzle of life drew us together, I guess. And yeah, she and really, you know, her life for all the years we were together was a creative life. She had been trained as a metalsmith. She had also apprenticed as a weaver and a spinner when she was a teenager. And, you know, she kind of took those as a launching point for a whole a creative life of making things. And that's how she sustained herself, primarily spiritually, because being a fiber and metal artist, especially if you're not kind of in the business of cranking out 1,000 of something, is not a way to make a living. But she certainly fed her soul, and I guess by proximity, my soul too. So.
The Netflix show keeps getting better and better because then there's bearded men with kayaks on their car. Would you like to tell us a little bit of what happened to Catherine?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I think one important part of the puzzle here is we moved to Prince Edward Island. We spent 10 years here, or 10 years together, without ever having talked about having children at all. And it was never really on our radar. We didn't not talk about having children. We just never, it never come up. And then one year we went home to Ontario, and on the long drive back from Ontario, the subject came up for the first time. And so this was probably like December 26th of 1999. And our son Oliver, as it happened, was conceived on New Year's Eve 1999. So
I have an Oliver too.
we did not mess around. It's a wonderful name.
I want to say that's kind of awesome that it was like the last night of the millennium. Very poignant.
Yes. So Oliver was born in 2000. He's 20 years old now. And so, you know, the last 20 years of Catherine's life was spent still living a creative life, but also very much being a mother as well. So, and you know, we had a good and interesting life as parents together. I think we sort of it was the best thing we ever did together. Oliver had a challenging, pretty normal pregnancy, but a challenging birth with some asphyxia and an emergency C-section and lots of time in the NICU. And so, and then kind of his early life, we kind of knew something was going on, but didn't know what it was. And he had an autism diagnosis when he was 3 that was inconclusive, and another one when he was 5 that was inconclusive. And then finally, at age 11, he had an autism diagnosis that said, oh, yeah, he's autistic. And so that, you know, that made for some challenging high-level parenting. Catherine, who was dyslexic all her life, kind of knew parts of that world, partly because she knew what it was like to live with a disability, and partly because she'd grown up with a lot of kind of atypical kids. So we kind of, you know, went along our merry way and supported Oliver and did what we thought we were supposed to do. And in the spring of 2014, that manifested with securing an autism assistance dog for Oliver. This big, strapping, 65-pound white poodle named Ethan,
Ethan.
who became part of our life, and we had always traveled as a young family, which I think was ultimately probably very good for Oliver, who, you know, who's very a creature of routine and habit. And when we took him to Thailand when he was 3 years old, that kind of threw him for a loop, but he figured it out. So once we got Ethan and Oliver's becoming a teenager and the kind of, you know, Oliver maybe someday moving out came onto the horizon. The summer of 2014, our first summer with Ethan, we thought we're not going to let having a dog and a teenage child stop us. And so we packed Ethan onto a plane and we spent 3 weeks driving around Europe in a VW microbus, camping and enjoying ourselves. And we got back from that trip, and August of 2014, Catherine went for just a regularly scheduled mammogram. And between August and October, maybe even September, she went from, oh, nothing wrong on the mammogram, to, oh, we saw something on the mammogram, to, we need to do a biopsy, to, you probably need a single mastectomy to you probably need a double mastectomy to you have metastatic breast cancer. There's no point in doing any mastectomies because you have metastatic breast cancer. So that was just like a whole heaping helping of wow. And yeah, so she lived with metastatic breast cancer, which manifested itself outside of the breast in her bone primarily from 2014 until January of 2020 when she died. And that was
hard.
Yeah, that was a hard, I don't want to ever do anything that hard again. It was a long 5 years. It was not a 5 years absent of life and laughing and joy, but there was a lot of, you know, by the time things were drawing to a close, I calling 911 and having the ambulance drop by was kind of a normal thing. So,
and like, by the hey, Ted. Hey, Carl. Yeah,
exactly. So, like, there was one time when I had like six paramedics in my living room, not because it was anything particularly unusual happening. It's just they all decided to come at once, I guess. So,
what was that like for Oliver? I mean, that's not something that fits in a box in a routine. What was that like for him? And then also for you as the parent and the partner?
On one level, I think it was not as hard as you might imagine because it was the only, she was the only mother he ever had. It was the only teenagehood. Like, it wasn't like it was a departure from what came before, but you know, it wasn't a break in tradition. It was just kind of, we'd had an interesting life and this was the next part of the interesting life. It was harder, I think, because it came, you know, he was 14, and that's just, it's hard being 14. And so having all of everything Catherine was going through, you know, adding to the stress in our household and then not having Catherine to support him through what he was going through as much as he did before, it really kind of all came to a head in 2016 when he started high school. And that was a big change in his routine. Catherine in the fall of 2016 was well enough to take one last trip by herself. She went to Spain with a friend of hers for 2 or 3 or I think 4 weeks in the end. And left me at home with Oliver, and he was just that concentrated period of time was like that. I think that was the hardest it got from a kind of father and son parenting perspective, but we made it out of that. And she came home and things actually kind of normalized for a while. And you know, I think we did it, but it wasn't easy. So
do you think that in a way her going away and you being the solo parent for a little while, has that given you some sense of like, actually, we can do this now that, you know, she's not coming back from Spain. It's all on you. You know what I'm saying?
There was a little bit of coming. This is a coming attractions for what's to come. Like it wasn't as though, you know, pretty well from 2 months into her cancer diagnosis, we knew that her cancer was incurable. You know, I knew that there was a sad ending at the end of it. And I knew I was going to be a single parent of a child of some age at the end of it. And so, yeah, being able to, I think this went largely unspoken other than to myself, but, you know, I was kind of testing out whether I had the chops to do it. And, you know, he was still alive at the end of it. So that was good.
This might not be a fair question, but you kind of knew what was coming, maybe not when it was coming, but like you said, they told you from the get-go, you weren't going to cure this. Do you feel like you were able to prepare yourself for what was to come? Or did you attempt to prepare yourself? I don't know if you ever can actually prepare yourself, but I wonder if you like tried to be proactive about it or if you just waited to see what it was going to be like.
I tried. Like I very early on, I tracked down a psychologist and started speaking with her just to kind of not so much try and fix anything as much as to kind of lay the groundwork for what I knew was coming. So there was that. I read a lot. I had some friends who had lost wives or partners to metastatic breast cancer that I was able to kind of get some of the lay of the land to, but it's not, I mean, the honest answer is no. I mean, there was no way I could prepare for it because it was part of preparing for it. It's like a meteor is going to strike Earth and it's sometime in the next 5 years at random. So you get ready for it. Like at some point you just have to keep on living. And I wouldn't say I put that worry part in a box because I couldn't put it in a box, but yeah, I just kind of gritted my teeth, I guess, as much as anything else, and tried to be a good caregiver and a good father and have some confidence that I'd get through it, I guess. So.
Okay, I have another question that's impossible. Are you ready?
Yes.
Do you think, in a way, it was better to know that she was not going to be cured? Or do you think it would have been better to have some hope and then have that hope dashed?
I guess there were small versions of hope, hope dashed, hope dashed, with every, you go through lines of cancer treatment and the tamoxifen works and then the tamoxifen doesn't work and then you go on to the next. So I think there was that kind of cadence of up and down and up and down, which I think it did inject bits of joy and hope into, a larger, longer story arc that was hopeless, I guess. I don't know. I've been going to a monthly grief support group for the last year and a bit. And, in the world of grieving people, there are people who lost their loved one instantly, and there are people who lost their loved one over 5 or 6 years. And I think they're different, but I don't think one is better or easier or harder than any of the other ones.
So, Peter, you mentioned that you heard our episode with Tregen White, which is our widower number two, is episode 32. What kinds of things were resonating with you when you listened to that as a widower?
I just think the idea, when I go to grief support group, I'm the only man there. And that I know that other partners of men are dying, so I know there are other grieving men out there. I don't know why they're not going to grief support group. And that I'm worried about that, not because it necessarily adversely ex affects my experience of grief support group. It's just that I know enough about what I've been going through, and I know enough about the times when I've kept things inside me and what that turns me into to know that it probably means there's a lot of angry, frustrated, non-communicative men out there who don't need to be that way if they could open themselves up in the way that Tregen did. So that was certainly an inspiration to me. And I've been writing a blog for the last 22 years, and for the longest time, after Catherine was diagnosed with cancer, I didn't use it as my kind of partner of cancer person blog, because I'd read a lot of partner of cancer person blogs, and they always had a really sad ending, and I didn't want to. I needed my writing space to be about other things. But as time wore on, I realized that I needed to write about it because it was happening to me and it was happening to other people. It was happening to Catherine, yes, but kind of, the circle of people in my reading community. And it helped me process it. I think I've done more of that after the fact. And I like to think that part of what I'm doing when I'm writing as a man who is being open about his vulnerability and his feelings and his grief is I'm giving other men permission to do the same. I'm making it seem less weird, I guess.
I love that you're doing that because, like we've talked about before, like in Tregen's episode specifically, we were asking him why men don't tend to open up as much, and there are all sorts of factors like upbringing and social constructs and things like that. Do you think that being partnered with somebody that is creative and giving you kind of that element of your life helped you as a guy to be more vulnerable? Or do you think that you have always been willing to kind of deviate from the norm?
I don't think I've always been willing to deviate from the norm in that respect. And I don't want to suggest that I've been good at being vulnerable and open all along. If you had talked to me this time last year, I was pretty convinced I could just power right through grief and I got this. And, yeah, other people have stuff to deal with, but, I've been preparing for this for 5 years. I don't need to talk to anyone or anything. And then in May of last year, it just kind of biggity bam boom, it just hit me like, I can't do this by myself. And in very short order, I went back to the psychologist. I signed up for an 8-week men's grief support group. I started talking to other men who were in my situation and found it enormously helpful. And I think if I went back and read what I was writing in public now, I think there was a corner a corner turn then that was really important. And, you know, so I think it was just realizing that I can't do this by myself. I can't power through it. I have to live it on its own timeline, and it's going to be hard. And once I realized that, it kind of made sense to try and talk about that, kind of to send the word back to those that come behind, I guess. So
I was going to ask you about that. I was going to say, do you know, or have you been introduced to any other male grievers, or have you just been surrounded by women? But it sounds like, yes, specifically you did find a group of other men. Yes.
Yeah, it was a small group, one of whom had lost.
It was just you, wasn't it? You were just talking to yourself.
Just me. No, there was another man who'd lost his wife just 3 or 4 months previous to me, and then another man who'd lost some very close relatives. And just, you know, talking about those things that did you open her closets yet? I mean, all those things that you know very well, just saying those things out loud, it was so helpful in a way that I never imagined that it would be. And, you know, I've been trying to, you know, I lost my father 3 months the day before Catherine died. And, you know, so my mother and I have been grieving the loss of our spouses together. And I think I've tried to be open about my process to her as well, just to kind of show her what's possible and try and, you know, as much as I can, be a model for her, not for her grief, but kind of for the kinds of things that are possible. So
does she come from the era where it's more like the stiff upper lip and don't share your feelings and, you know, don't air your dirty laundry kind of a generation?
I think she, not the kind of ultimate, you know, leave it to Beaver expression of that, but certainly I think that is, but I think both my parents kind of came from that school. And so, you know, the fact, I know for my father, especially, the idea that I was writing about my life online in public for 20 years, kind of, I mean, he could not imagine why anyone would ever want to do that.
So Peter, tell us a little bit about marbles and what that has to do with you.
Well, almost from the get-go after Catherine's diagnosis, you know, she had a large family and a large community of friends around the world. And I think, you know, after I tried to send individual emails to every one of those people for the first week, I realized that wasn't scalable. And I knew very early on, just from listening to Catherine, that one of the really hard things for her was to just keep, you know, it was to answer that, how are you doing, Catherine, question 1,000 times a week. So she gave me the permission to start not a blog, but an email newsletter for that kind of larger community. And it started off at 20 or 30 people and grew to almost 100 people by the time she died. And that was the place that I wrote about, basically I answered the question, how is Catherine doing? And so it was kind of the very much, you know, cut from the same cloth as the traditional newsletter written by supporter of person living with cancer. Sometimes Catherine, as I said, was dyslexic. She would have perhaps written it herself otherwise, but didn't. So I kind of filled that role for her and tried to be as open, not necessarily about the emotional journey, although I didn't kind of run from that, but it was mostly just this treatment starts here, this radiation starts here. It was kind of the, you know, it was a way, as I said, of keeping people up to date. And I wrote it in the moment, often, you know, returning from the cancer treatment center and just wanted to get the word out to people before the phone calls started from everyone. And I didn't write it with the anticipation of it being anything more than that. But then after Catherine died, you know, and I sent out the last email, I had a chance to sit with the words for a while. I didn't really go back to them immediately, but maybe 9 months afterwards, I started to reread them. And I realized what I had missed being in my position was any kind of guide for what was going to come next. And not necessarily, like, everyone will talk about the early days, and everyone will kind of talk on a certain surface level about what it's like to have a family living with someone living with cancer. But, you know, the hard parts at the end, like the palliative cares and the funerals and the, you know, how all that happens. I didn't know, like, you were asking me earlier about preparing. I didn't know what I was preparing for. And that was one of the scariest bits. And, you know, I knew that every journey is different and that I couldn't write a kind of here's exactly what's going to happen manual for people. But it occurred to me reading the words that I'd written that if I gave them another form, maybe I could hand that to someone who was following along behind me, either someone living with cancer who wants to help their family or someone supporting someone living with cancer. And so I started the hard work of kind of, I didn't edit them, but I kind of mushed them into a book form and then figured out how to have books produced and ordered.
You didn't print them yourself?
No, I didn't print them
over
myself.
Many midnight hours?
Over several years, yes.
Yeah. To the Anne of Green Gables soundtrack, yeah, exactly. Not the Newsy soundtrack.
No. But I initially, thinking that the audience for this would be relatively small, had five copies printed, and then happened to talk to the owner of the local bookstore, and he wanted five copies up front, and so I needed to print more, and then was interviewed by the local radio station, and that kind of prompted some more requests for it. So ultimately, over kind of between November and January, he sold about 100 copies. Again, not a great way to earn a living, but very emotionally satisfying. So, and you know, that turns out to have been a really good idea from a number of perspectives. One, and maybe most selfishly, is that it allowed me to take those words and literally put them on a shelf. And which is not to say I made them go away, because they're still there, they're still in my head, but it kind of allows me to put a wrapping around them and kind of think about them as, okay, there was that time and now that time is on the shelf and now there's another time happening.
I love that.
It's been really helpful. And, you know, but I can also take the book off the shelf when I want to revisit it. And I have done that because it's in chronological order. So I can, in March of 2017, this is what was happening to us. So
I've thought about my own life in terms of a book and how some people talk about grief as if like you're closing that book and then you're moving on. But it's like, well, actually, no, it's just another chapter of the same book, right? Because it's your whole life. But you've taken that and you've given it a way to keep it, but also not carry it on your shoulders all of the time to be able to free yourself from it a little bit.
Yeah. The metaphor I've been using just very recently is not a book, but a TV show, in as much as I kind of picture myself preparing for season two of the TV show. And season two has many of the same characters as season one, including me. One of the main characters died and we need to resolve that. But yeah.
Wait.
You know.
I think maybe you should just get a new actor and see if anybody notices.
You know, like on Bewitched.
On Bewitched, yeah.
Even though they didn't die, there's two Darrens.
Nobody ever addresses
that. But who
that.
Could take Catherine's spot? I mean, come on.
I think psychologically that would be advised against on all different levels.
I think that people would be like, I think Peter's gone crazy. You're like, this is Catherine.
Yeah.
Just a different Catherine. What's the name of the book?
It's called Using Her Marbles.
Not losing.
No, using her marbles.
Yeah.
And the story behind the Using Her Marbles is that Catherine had a metastatic breast cancer support group on Facebook. And one of the things she read there was this kind of metaphor for how you deal with the day-to-day loss of energy and stamina. And one suggestion was you kind of picture yourself as waking up with 100 marbles and you kind of apportion those over the course of the day. You know, going out with a friend for coffee might take 50 marbles, but, you know, so you have to figure, okay, was that going to give me enough marbles to make it through the rest of the day? And, you know, I think she really successfully used that metaphor from that point until she died as a way of budgeting herself and learning how to say no to people who wanted to spend time with her, or, you know, it worked out. And so, you know, I think it's kind of a metaphor for how she lived with cancer and how we lived as a family living with cancer. So
was she able to continue creating and expressing herself through artwork close to the end, or was that something she had to give up?
She had to change it, but no, she never really stopped creating. She had had a beautiful studio that was located about two blocks from where I'm talking to you that was on the second floor of an old Victorian building that overlooked
the Anne of Green Gables gift shop.
The Anne of Green Gables gift shop is actually literally five doors down. So, yeah.
And I was just joking.
Don't make jokes about Anne because they're all true.
He's so over it.
I'm sorry. This is how we are.
Ultimately, in the spring of 2019, she couldn't climb the stairs to her studio anymore. And so it turned out that I'm in the basement. I'm talking to you from the basement of the Anglican Church Hall, which is where my shop studio is. And there was a room across the hall that was open. So for the last 2 years of her life, Catherine actually was my office mate. She moved her studio across the hall, which was really the first time we'd ever worked together. So we would leave our doors open and I'd see her quilting and she'd see me printing and hacking away at what I do. And that's actually just right. Like it's our house is right across the street. We're at 101 Prince and our house is at 100 Prince. So that really all worked out well. And it allowed her to keep, you know, the last project that she did was a quilt for my bed for me that was delivered to me after she died.
I bet those things are so priceless to you now, because when you create art, I feel like you imbue it with a part of your soul. And so it's like you have pieces of her soul, and especially like if she created it for you. Oh,
yeah. It's, you know, although it certainly wasn't the hardest thing I've had to do, you know, one of the things I had to do last year was clean out her studio. And that in a way was maybe the most intimate thing that I'd ever done, because that was her innermost life, you know, the tools and materials and a lifetime of collecting fabric and things. And I didn't want to just throw it away, but it did feel kind of like, you know, she died and here I was taking this physical manifestation of her and purposefully disassembling it. And it felt like an assault almost. So the way I came to terms with that is I just worked really hard to find good homes for the things. And so there's a local group of grandmothers who have a yearly fabric sale. So I gave them all her fabric, and I found someone who was looking for a spinning wheel. And it took about 6 months to finally draw it to a close. But now there's a veteran support group that uses her studio space. So
yeah. It's not like throwing away their toothbrush where you're like, we can just get rid of that.
Yeah. So that, and that was, you know, the day I closed the door on that, that was a bittersweet day, because it was, you know, I took down the sign that she had on the door of her studio, but it was behind me too. And that was good and satisfying, and to know that I had done that. So, yeah.
It's always so packed with emotions. It's like, it's a good thing and it's a bad thing at the same time. And you never can quite figure out what it is, because our brains are so binary, you know, and it's like, I don't know what to label this as, hard and good at the same time.
I mean, I place way too much emphasis on this, but one of the first things I did that I remember from the months after Catherine died is I rearranged the cutlery drawer in the kitchen to be the way that I always thought it should have been. And that kind of felt like asserting my dominion over my own life in a way that seems kind of, nobody else understands this, but it was so important to me. And, you know, that whole, you know, Oliver and I continued to live in the house that we shared with Catherine. And I don't want to erase Catherine from it, because she, you know, her visual sensibility is all over the house. It's in the paint colors and it's in the art on the walls. But I also don't want to live under the shadow of her. So, you know, that kind of delicate balance is something I've been dancing through for the last year.
So Peter is in our Widow Wives Club. And Peter, you made a really interesting and poignant post recently, and it had to do with dating and some of the observations that you made about yourself and your emotions and your caregiving and your past. Can you tell our listeners about that? Because I think it's so important and a lot of people will resonate with this.
Yeah, I mean, the whole idea of dating is like one of those, it's one of the harder things to deal with as a widower, because there's nobody to talk to about it, because there's this kind of strongly held, implicit, never explicitly stated, you're supposed to mourn Catherine for the rest of your life, of course. And so dealing with that and kind of deciding not only when I'm right to think about that, but kind of when the world is right for me, or deciding that I don't care when the world is right for me, it's about me. You know, that was something that took a long time to get around to. One of the things that I had to come to terms with is, you know, we talk about this idea of acceptance and as one of the stages of grief. And I came up with this conception for acceptance, which is that it's not that I'm accepting that Catherine's died, because that was kind of self-evident. It's that I accepted the role that she played in my life and what we had together. I accepted that into myself. I kind of found a place for that to live on in me in a way that wasn't going to obviate the possibility of something else in my life. It wasn't going to erase her from my life, but I had to kind of find a place for her, a permanent home for her in my heart, if that makes any sense. Once I kind of found my way to that, this spring, after having last year worked with a psychologist, a social worker was recommended to me. And I never knew what social work was or what social workers did, but I'm always out looking for help. And so I called her up and made an appointment. And my first question to her was, "What does social workers
What do
do?"
you do?
And she was really helpful. She basically explained it to me. Her vision of it was that psychologists are kind of the microeconomic aspect of life, and social workers are the macroeconomics, the kind of the broader strokes. And so, whereas, you know, I would talk to my psychologist about what I was feeling and processing my feelings and whether I was sleeping and, you know, those kinds of deep emotional things, my social worker is more about helping me. It's not only about the future, but it's primarily about the future, and it's kind of designing what it is that I want to do next. And one of the really helpful things that she told me, and really, I guess, allowed me to connect with myself about, is that relating to other people is important in this life. Because I kind of thought, in a way, kind of closed the book on that, and or not closed the book on it, but kind of suspended the book on that. So the idea that it could be okay to look for companionship with someone else, that took me a lot of time to get to and admit that it was okay, and like be okay with that myself. And so once I had gotten to that point, that was interesting then, because then it's, you know, what do I do next? And so I signed up for Bumble, because that's what people seem to do, and immediately was presented with all the women in my small town who were single, which kind of freaked me out, because, you know, I live in this small town, so it's like, oh, I used to be friends with her brother, and she interviewed me once for the rate, you know. So that was kind of weird. And then the really weird thing is that I had to describe myself and kind of, you know, I had to say what I was looking for, and I didn't know what I was looking for. And to answer your original question, I realized all I knew how to do was to care for people. You know, I've been caring for Oliver for 20 years. I cared for Catherine in a form for a long time, but, you know, actively during her cancer. And I was really good at that. But that was not about me, that was about them. So the idea that I should be now allowed to say, oh, I'm looking for someone to do this with, or I'm looking for a person like, you know, that was just like, I'd never been in a position really ever to ask that question of myself. So the next thing I did was unsign up for Bumble, because I realized I needed to give that some more thought and think about, like, what actually is it outside of, because I know that there's a danger. I know this intuitively, and I know this from talking to my social worker, that there's a danger that I'll just look for someone else who needs care, and I'll fall into that model again, which is very, I know how to do it. It's comfortable. It's fulfilling. It's not a, you know, an equitable, it's not the basis upon which to build an equitable relationship necessarily. So I need to be really mindful about not doing that and figuring out how to not do that.
It's almost like you have to figure out who you are without your person, because your identity has been for so long that it's you and her, and together, even though you're two separate people, you know, it's such a big part of your own identity. It's almost like, who am I now and what do I want? And yeah.
There was a book that I think you referenced in an earlier episode that got posted to the Facebook group before and after loss that I found really helpful. And, you know, one very early on there's a reference to healing, restoration, and growth. And I realized the growth part I never really factored into the equation. I understood about healing and I understood about restoration, which I took to mean kind of, you know, getting back to the point where we all have clean clothes and we're eating 3 square meals a day and Oliver's getting to his day program on time, like just kind of returning things to some level of practical and emotional normalcy. It never had occurred to me that there was something that had to do with me and my needs that would come next, which I think is really what the growth thing is about. So no, I think you're exactly right. Like that, I kind of now feel like I'm faced with this empty canvas or empty playing field that I had never really had cause to consider. It's, you know, it's disabling because it's like none of the familiar signposts are here. It feels like wandering around in the dark. It feels in a way like I'm 25 years old again, and that doesn't seem fair. But it's also on the upside, you know, it's a land of endless possibility in theory. So,
yeah, it's the season 2. Hopefully yeah. This one doesn't end tragically like season 1 did.
But if it does, you have experience.
Yeah. And that's, you know, the clarion call of my social worker when she's encouraging me to take risks is what's the worst thinking that could happen, especially when I held someone's hand as they were dying. I mean, it doesn't get much worth it. So if I ask someone out for coffee and they say no, well, okay, that's okay. I'll ask someone out for coffee. So
I think this is such an important conversation because, I mean, Peter, you've been in grief groups. You're in our Widow Wives Club. Anita, we talk to people all the time and we're in various grief groups. We see these common threads of when their person dies, when somebody's person dies, they don't know who they are anymore without that person, with a lot of aspects, with intimacy, with day-to-day functioning, with meals. Right now we're doing a food kind of challenge with some of our widowers and widows, and it's interesting to see some of the feedback, like, well, I don't care about eating because I ate with my person and like that's gone, and now I don't have my person to tell me, well, you look good, or hey, let's do this challenge together. So I'm really grateful that you shared your observation of that you need to look at yourself, Peter, because I think a lot of us, we just keep going and we forge ahead, and that's one thing that does need to be addressed. So thanks for sharing that.
I called at grief support group the other week. I made reference to what I've come to call in my internal head, the kingdom of the grievers. And the people who live in the kingdom of the grievers, understand something unique. Like, we are all bonded in a unique way, very different manifestations of that bond, but you know, I think we understand something that other people don't understand. And I think one of the things I've come to understand is that I'm not the same person anymore, and that manifests itself in all sorts of different ways. I mean, it manifests itself in who I'm attracted to, but also what food I like and who my friends are. And you know, there are friends who I was very close to who I may never speak to again, not because, you know, we're having a feud. It's just that we're not compatible anymore because I'm a different person. So you're right. There is that kind of wholesale reinvention. Like I know who I am. I recognize myself in the mirror, but I also know that I've been irrevocably changed by this. And I was overwhelmed by that for the longest time. I'm starting to see the shreds of, maybe shreds not the right word, the sparkles of opportunity in that.
I also, just to piggyback off of what Mel was saying about how I think this is so healthy, I also think it's healthy that you were able to kind of recognize the pattern that you might fall into. And instead of trying to jump into a relationship, maybe to fix some of the feelings of loss or loneliness or not being whole because you've lost your identity, instead of trying to kind of patch that up with a new relationship, to stop and to say, actually, who am I? What do I want? What's my purpose? What's my goal? Instead of just kind of trying to feel your way through that, but be really intentional about it so that you don't end up getting into a relationship that you're not ready for or is not actually going to fulfill you and make you the best person that you are.
I'm very conscious of the fact that the thing I need most of all right now is a good and healthy life as myself. And that doesn't mean I need to do that alone. And it doesn't mean I need to do that, without connections to other people. But, you know, the thing about supporting someone through cancer and the thing about, you know, the relationship, the nature of the relationship we had before, you know, we spending 28 years with someone, that's a pretty deep Vulcan mind meld going on. And the idea that, you know, I can't get that with someone else right now. I may get that over time with someone else, but on day one, that's weird. And I need to learn about how to do that because I know how to do Vulcan mind meld, but I don't know how to do going for coffee particularly well, although I think I can learn.
I love that you are saying these things, and especially because as we become widows and widowers, our identity changes, like we've talked about. And also, I think our definition of what failure is or of what something, what a good thing is or a bad thing is. And so some you could look at you getting on Bumble and then getting off of Bumble as a failure, or you could look at it a different way, like I believe you're doing in, oh, no, I'm just reassessing and taking care of things. And so I think that's important, too, because I know, at least looking at my own journey, some things I've thought of as failures. Like, I was only able to get out of bed today, and I did not brush my teeth for, like, 3 days. I am a failure. Instead of looking at it like, look what I'm dealing with. What are the things I was able to do? And so it's inspiring to hear you talk about this and to not judge yourself for getting off of Bumble and reassessing. And I think that's another important thing that widowers and widows need to hear, too. So thank you for sharing.
Another thing that I've come to realize recently is that I'm Catherine used to be responsible for 50%, give or take on any given day, of raising our son with me. And now I'm responsible for 100% of it. And, you know, first of all, I have this sudden great sense of kinship with single parents everywhere that I feel guilty for not having had before because it's really hard. But I also realized I can't tie my emotional health to what kind of day Oliver's having, because he's going to have his own life and his own emotional ups and downs, and I can't fix everything. And, I don't have all the skills that Catherine had is part of it, but also it's just unreasonable for one person to, you know, be able to think that they can emotionally maintain a child, no matter how, fantastic a parent I am. And so just letting Oliver be Oliver and being happy with what I am able to do to support him, that's been a long time coming. Because I used to think, you know, that every time he would have a meltdown, I must have done something wrong. I failed as a parent. And that's just not sustainable. Like, I couldn't go on like that. And that was a good thing to realize as a result. So I very much profited from, you know, the thing that you're hosting on Facebook. And that has given me, you know, I've profited from what I've read there. And I profited from that safe space that you've created through your rigorous vetting process. That is not, I can write there in a way that I can't write really anywhere else. It's also made me realize that the widow experience and the widower experience, kind of on a very general basis, are two kind of distinctly different things. And they overlap considerably, but they are different. And that's, you know, for a whole bunch of different reasons for every person, I imagine.
Well, I hope that there's going to be another person who comes after you who listens to your interview, just like you listen to Tregan's, and realizes that it's okay to try and address your grief and not just try and power through, and it's okay to try and connect with people, and it's okay to be vulnerable, and it's okay to, you know, join groups and talk about your feelings. And like you were saying, you didn't realize how helpful it was going to be just to talk about opening up a closet with somebody else who understood the gravity of what that meant. So I hope that, and I think that it will happen this way, that other people will listen to you and it will give them the permission that they might need to be able to do some of that work for themselves. And if you're listening to this podcast and you're a widower and you have been hesitant to reach out and join the Widow Wives Club, Peter will be there. He'll be nice to you.
I will be. And there are, I'm not alone as a widower there. You know, there are others, and, you know, and that has been helpful too. So
there are definitely more widows than widowers, which statistically is also, I mean, that's how it is. There are more widows than there are widowers, but I think there's definitely a disparity in the number of each of them in the world, but also represented in our group.
I was talking to my mother just over the past week, and I realized that I'd never known this, but I come from a long line of widowers. My grandfather, my mother's father, lost my grandmother when my mother was 5 years old. His father lost his wife 10 years before he died. His father lost his wife 25 years before he died. So I try and take a sense of resilience from that, I guess, that the men on my mother's side of the family in my DNA that I inherited from them have some kind of something.
You're cursed
or empowered.
Empowered. Let's take the empowered over the cursed. Yeah.
Peter, I find that you have a lot of wisdom and knowledge. So thank you so much for sharing. Mel, do you want to ask him the most important question of all time and eternity and space?
Yes. Peter, what is your favorite cheese?
Oh, there is a cheese that I've been getting from the local farmer's market that comes from France that I don't know how to pronounce it because I don't speak French, but it's spelled C-O-M-T-E. Maybe it's Comte, or Comte. Ooh. It has an accent on the E, but it's Comte, but it's really good. It's like a hard French cheese with some bite to it. It's good with grilled cheese sandwiches. Highly, highly recommended. Can I give you a second cheese?
You sure can.
There's a Scottish cheese, which I get from the same place, called Mull of Kintyre, which is a sharp cheddar. And it's also very good on grilled cheese. So,
okay. Fun fact. I know that's a place. It's also a song that Paul McCartney wrote, Mull of Kintyre.
And a cheese.
And Rod Stewart covered, didn't he, I think?
Did he?
I think so.
I'll have to check.
There you go. I don't know any of this.
Awesome. Peter, thank you so much for joining us. It's been so great to have you.
That was lots of fun. Thank you.
Thank you so much for joining us, Peter, today. We hope that everybody who's listened to this episode has found it helpful. And we hope especially that the widowers out there have felt empowered and enlightened by listening to Peter's story. Remember to check out the Widow Wives Club on Facebook. Answer all the questions. We like to keep it a very safe space, like Peter was saying. If you want to check out our Patreon, it's patreon.com/WWDN.
If you'd like to buy us some tacos, you can go to buymeacoffee.com/widowwedonow.
Until we talk to you next time, I'm Anita.
I'm Mel.
And I'm Peter.
And we're just two young widows and one widower who stays up at night making printing press things. And we're trying to figure out
widow we do now. This is my favorite thing to discuss with you.
Tell me, what is it?
One of my favorite things. I do enjoy tacos and cheese and dogs. This is about how you cannot pay hundreds and hundreds of dollars for a phone plan, especially when you're a widow, your person is dead, you might have kids, you might need another option, and you just want your phone to work, you want unlimited texting and service, and you want it to be like $25 a month.
It blows my mind that they have plans that start at $15 a month. That is so cheap. And the cool thing is it uses other 5G networks, and so you don't have to pay extra for that, and you still get great service.
Yep. Anita and I have traveled all over, and I have used my phone. So I highly recommend it. And my mom's even on it. When my dad died, we put his phone down to the cheapest plan, which is $15 a month. And I think my mom's on the $20 a month plan, and it's so worth it. It's so much cheaper than what we were all paying before. So I highly recommend it if you're on a budget or not. Who cares? Ryan Reynolds is in charge of the company, and they send you free stickers with Ryan Reynolds temporary tattoos. It's kind of the best. So if somebody wants to sign up, what can they do, Anita?
Go to trymintmobile.com/WWDN. Seriously, you guys, such a great idea. Save yourself some money.
And if you're worried about losing data or having any changes with your phone, not going to happen. They walk you through it. Everything's fine. It's the easiest process of all time. Again, that's
trymintmobile.com/WWDN.